advisement, and we move to the second case this morning, Farrell versus Amoco Insurance. Mr. Burkhart.
Thank you. Please, the court, your honors, counsel. My name is Tom Burkhart, and I represent Mr. Lyle Liurla in this particular case. As the court well knows, from the briefs, this case involves the question of whether or not in this particular case, with this particular policy of insurance, contractors' work is covered under the policy. In dealing with this case, I wanted to impress upon the court what I thought the district court did wrong. First of all, I believe the court was sucked into the defense bar's idea that in Illinois there's some per se law that says an insurance company cannot write a policy which will cover defective work. And I would suggest that is not the law.
Isn't that the import of the Viking construction case?
Not exactly. The facts of the Viking case are such that the policy in that particular case indicated that it would not cover defective work, whether it was done by anybody, whether it's done by a subcontractor or the contractor. And what it's our position that understanding the nature of the general contractor's job and the way in which they orchestrate things makes their job, their work, their product different. And it very well is. In fact, one of the exhibits we attached to the amended complaint, which was not allowed, shows that my client, in fact, inquired about what this coverage was that says his work will be covered if the damage to that work is caused by a subcontractor. And I guess that jumps me straight to the crux of this case where I think the court erred. That particular clause is not mentioned in the district court's opinion.
Well, that's because the district court didn't have to get there, having found no occurrence and no property damage.
the subcontractor
exception is an exception to an exclusion and need not be consulted unless there's a coverage grant in the first instance.
Well, if that's the case, then you would never get to the coverage in the first place. In other words, what you do is write that basically that language would not have a place in the policy at all.
The subcontractor exclusion in CGL policies restores coverage that is otherwise excluded by the business risk exclusion. It doesn't create coverage that independent of the general coverage grant in the policy. It restores coverage that's otherwise excluded. So you've got to get past that first hurdle of an occurrence and property damage before you even get to any of the business risk exclusions, which it seems to me is another hurdle for you, even if the district court erred on the analysis of occurrence and property damage.
Well,
let's start there. Let's just take it one step at a time. Why is this an occurrence? What's the property damage? And then if we get to the business risk exclusion and the subcontractor exception, we can talk about that.
Okay. I believe that the occurrence, that when you talk about an occurrence, you talk about an accident. That's what the policy defines. And in this particular instance, what is an accident? It's something that is not foreseeable by the insured. And it is my suggestion in our briefs and otherwise, and the crux of our argument is that a subcontractor's work that harms my work as a general contractor is never foreseeable. You hire people with the anticipation that they will do their job and they will do it correctly and they will not, if you will, damage or hurt my product or my work. And as I point out in this particular case, it is our position that the work here wasn't the underlying complaint. What did in fact contain factual allegations which showed that my work, my product, as a general contractor, which is the overall house, and if you want to get into specifics, the drywall, the tile, things that needed to be, that should have been laid in the first place, were harmed by virtue of subcontractors' work. We get to that point. At the very crux, I guess, of the thrust of my argument is this, that I'm not real sure under these circumstances that AMCO gets to raise those policy defenses, having refused to defend us under reservation of rights, and having failed to file a declaratory judgment action prior to the conclusion of the underlying case.
It's entitled to take that risk and wait to be sued.
Once it does, it loses the definitional, basically the policy defense of what is and isn't an occurrence. And
why would that be?
Well, because I would suggest that under the Eclipse Manufacturing Company case, which was cited in the case, that if you take that course, you have got to be very, very certain that there's never a chance, or the facts that are alleged, or even unpled facts, as one case suggests, the Tillerson case said, unpled facts, which if known to the insurance company, are out there that would give rise to liability under the policy, then you have an obligation to take the course of either defending under a reservation of rights or filing for a DJ prior to the conclusion of the underlying case.
I thought
if you fail to do that,
I thought Illinois law provided three options. One,
well,
the first two are the ones that you just mentioned, but
and
the third
the
option
safest.
Is to refuse and just wait to be sued and then litigate the coverage issue.
I agree that. The first, I'm sorry, I probably jumped ahead and wasn't listening to the tail end of your statement, but my understanding is that the Illinois law provides a situation where you have three options, the third of which is the most risky, and the third of which I think this court has once before said, we stack the deck in favor of the insured on that when you take that option all the time.
Well, that just means, you know, you might be liable for breach of contract and possibly bad faith, but it doesn't mean you forego or are somehow estopped from raising arguments based on the policy language. I don't understand Illinois to have that sort of a rule.
I think it does. Yes, you are estopped from raising policy defenses if you don't take action before the end of the underlying case.
Is there an allegation of negligence here?
Negligence in the underlying suit with regard to my client or with regard to...
Well, I mean, are you charging the contractor with... Or you're the contractor. Are you charging him with negligence?
If the question is, has he been charged in the underlying suit with some form of negligence, I would suggest that the theory that was alleged was breach of contract. That's what it was labeled.
It's a breach of contract suit. That's,
no.
That's basically why you can't proceed here. You can't claim coverage under this contract.
I would agree with you if Illinois courts ended the inquiry there. But not only the Illinois courts, but this court sitting and applying Illinois law have long held that the inquiry is not just the label that a plaintiff might put on the underlying complaint. An insurance company has to do much more than just, look, it's the title of the caption of count one is breach of contract.
Do you know of any case in Illinois where the allegation has been breach of contract, where this kind of policy has been held to cover the damages?
Where this particular policy has been held to cut the... Well, I would suggest the car case is one. I would suggest that the car case is one, Country Mutual versus Car. That is one Illinois case.
There's negligence in that case.
Well, right, but...
That's why I asked you the question in the first place.
Right, well, but again, the... Del Monte Fresh Produce NA Inc. versus Transport Insurance Company, 500 Fed 3rd 640, is a Seventh Circuit case that was decided that said legal labels in the complaints are often incomplete or missing altogether. What is important is not the legal label that the plaintiff attaches to the defendant, that is the insured's conduct, but whether that conduct, as alleged in the complaint, is at least arguably within one or more of the categories of wrongdoing that the policy covers. Just labeling, I think that case is on point to say just labeling the complaint a breach of contract is not going to absolve the insurer. You must look at the facts surrounding the complaint itself. In this particular complaint, there were allegations of defective work, damage to the drywall, damage to, I mean, there was a whole punch list that the insured had in his
position.
That's
all breach of warranty, isn't it? It's breach of contract.
I don't believe that you can categorize it as far as labeling it goes. It is my understanding of the law is that you must look beyond what the mere legal labels of the complaint are and see what is in fact in play here. The question here is, do we have damage to our work or our product? And the answer is yes. If it is, and it's not foreseeable, I suggest, and it is our position, that that is an accident as defined in this particular policy. The Carr case addresses the issue of what is an accident, and it says what is basically unforeseen by the insured. But we know the case law that says that, you know, hey, we're going to look at this insurance policy and what a reasonable person in the position of the insured would understand it to mean. And if the policy says we're going to cover your work and then lists exclusions to that under the completed operations hazard, then if the exclusion is that we're not going to cover your work, any damage to your work away from your product, away from your address, except that this exclusion does not include damage to your work that's caused by a subcontractor, then of necessity, that particular coverage applies. And if a subcontractor, and that's why you would...
No trouble with that. It's not coverage. It's an exclusion.
Well, I think it defines, it gets to the definition of what is meant by an accident in this case. We have to also understand who has control of this policy in the first place. Is it the insured or is it the insurer? It's the insurer who writes this policy. If the insurer is going to basically leave open the thought in the insured, if the insurer is going to leave the insured with the thought that he will be covered, his product will be covered if damage to his product is caused by a subcontractor, then certainly that should be construed to provide coverage for the insured, because the policy must be viewed as most liberally in favor of coverage. In this particular case, we have an insured who's actually being charged a premium for this subcontractor coverage and inquires about what is this coverage. And the letter, as the facts turned out to be, that was attached to the First Amendment complaint, I believe, the one that was not allowed, but which was eventually allowed into the record, basically that exhibit shows that there's a premium being charged because of the additional risk that a subcontractor poses when you don't do, when the general doesn't do the work himself. I believe each of the cases, including Viking, and that are cited by the insurance company in this case, all have general statements of what is or isn't covered by a generally in Illinois, a general liability policy isn't going to cover defective work. Well, if this court is of the opinion that an insurance company can never write a policy that would cover defective work under some circumstance, then I lose, because that would be a black letter law. But I don't think that's what the Illinois courts, that's not the standard they apply. The standard they apply is the one I think that's most recently stated in the Carr case. And that standard is all the precedents in the world will help, but until you take a look at the terms of the policy in your particular case and the facts as they are developed in the investigation of the underlying claim, you have to apply the facts of the underlying claim to the policy to determine whether or not there is coverage. In this particular case, the insurance company simply blew it. There was ample evidence that we had damage to my client's work, the general contractor's work, by virtue of a subcontractor's action. If you want to say that you're not going to get there because there's no occurrence, I suggest the language of the policy defines, the overall language of the policy defines what an occurrence is and what an accident is. An accident is something that's not fortuitous. I mean, or is this an unlucky event? You know, something that's not foreseen. And I to this day, I don't think you can characterize this particular conduct as something that is foreseen. I was trying to think of what might be a good example. If you're working on your own house, let's say it's drywall work, for example, and you run into it or bang into it and put a big gaff in the drywall, that's an accident. That's something that's not foreseen. The same is it as if you hire somebody and they put the hole in the wrong place. Now, also an element of damage that was sustained in this was loss of use. I don't think you can discount that. That is an expressly covered thing. The definitions are different in this policy And I think you have to take a look at the overall definitions. In loss of use, you don't.
I think in the car case that you mentioned, a bulldozer ran into a wall, if I remember the case, and that was regarded as an occurrence. But I don't think you, and that seems to me to be a close case at best, but you don't have a similar situation here that I know of.
I believe in the car case it was the backfilling which caused the wall to push in.
Well, not a bulldozer, a backfiller.
Well, right? It is. That's not, in my opinion, too far different from somebody ramming a ladder into a drywall or cutting holes in the wrong place. I don't think that's wrong. That's different. It's certainly not different from the tile incident, you know, where you have to rip up an entire floor. I just think under these circumstances, you have to look at the entire policy and all of the facts in the underlying claim that were in the possession of the insured to determine whether or not there's coverage. And if you apply that standard here, I think you will come to the conclusion that there was, in fact, coverage. There was, in fact, an incident and an occurrence.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Mr. Parsons?
May it please the Court, my name is Brian Parsons, and I represent the appellee AMCO Insurance Company in this matter. Before I get to some of the points I wanted to make, I wanted to address a couple issues that were brought up by counsel for LIERLA. Number one being, I guess, the argument that if the insurance company doesn't file a declaratory judgment action, that they're then stopped from not only asserting policy defenses, but in essence, looking at the policy at all. I mean, if the policy says, you know, there's only coverage if there's an occurrence, there's property damage, and they can no longer show, well, whether or not there's an occurrence or property damage, then there's no point in looking at the policy at all. And essentially anything would be covered, and by not filing a declaratory judgment action, the insurance company has no recourse. And the case law does not say that. As the court pointed out, there's three options. And in the Elko liquidation case, one of the options is if by comparing the complaints with the policy and there's clearly no coverage, then the insurance company has no obligation to do anything. Additionally, as this issue was brought up, there's been no motion to strike filed on the declaratory judgment action issue. There's been no motion to dismiss. All these same issues were raised as an affirmative defenses, so in essence, it's a matter of form over substance, and the issues of whether or not there's coverage and if there's property damage under the policy are still the relevant inquiry for the court. Additionally, in regarding to the amended complaint that was sought to be filed by counsel for LIERLA in July of 2007, this was an amended complaint seeking to add counts for breach of fiduciary duty. AMCO responded to this attempt to amend the complaint by pointing out that the only case that was being relied on by LIERLA to incorporate counts for breach of fiduciary duty, the breach of fiduciary duty would only be triggered if there was a duty to defend and that duty to defend was breached. Now, considering there was a motion for summary judgment that had already been heard and briefed before the district court at that point, district court determined that an amendment to the pleadings at this point would have no point, particularly when there was no explanation given in the motion seeking leave to file an amended complaint as to why any counts for breach of fiduciary duty were not included when the initial lawsuit was filed over a year previously. And under these circumstances, there's no abuse of discretion by the district court in not allowing an amendment to the pleading. But at its base, this case gets down to the key issue of whether or not there is coverage under not just any policy, but this specific policy. And in reading this specific policy, you look at the language contained within it and also Illinois courts that have already determined what constitutes coverage, what constitutes an occurrence, what constitutes property damage under using this language. As mentioned by the court, Viking Construction outlined the three different approaches that have been used to determine whether or not there's coverage for defective construction claims against a general contractor, and have found that these claims are not covered under a commercial general liability policy. The first reason being that, just in general, breach of contract claims are not covered under CGL policies. The court in HydroCorp and in Viking both found that there's simply no coverage for breach of contract allegations against a...
Is that rule in a state of flux in Illinois as it is in many other states?
I haven't seen any case law to indicate that it is. It seems like the Carr case has been focused on is, well, this is the reason why everything's changing, and that's why they, you know, Counselor Falerla wanted to file an amended or a supplemental motion for summary judgment. But the Carr case deals with a negligence action. This case, very clearly, by examining the complaint that was filed against Falerla, it's entitled breach of contract, but you don't have to stop and just look at that. You can evaluate the entire complaint. And in each instance, there's a breach of the contract that is referenced. This is the contract language. This is how the contract was breached by Falerla. And under those circumstances, it's clear that this is a case of breach of contract and as such is not covered by a CGL policy.
So do you understand Illinois to essentially require that insurance coverage claims be evaluated according to the legal theory of the underlying complaint or the category of the claim, or that there's a broader look at the underlying complaint to see what sort of allegations are being made?
Oh, I think both. And I think that, as the Viking court outlined, this is one of the three approaches that the courts dealing with these types of defective construction issues have taken to determine that there is, in fact, no coverage. One of the other methods that the courts have utilized is by an examination into whether or not there has been an occurrence under the policy. Very clearly, when establishing whether or not there's coverage under a policy, a CGL policy, is whether or not there's been an occurrence, whether or not there's been property damage. The policy defines an occurrence as being an accident. And as the court in Wilfred's construction case examined, a very similar set of circumstances. And in that case, Wilfred's, the general contractor, claimed that it was accidental and an occurrence because some of the work that was performed was actually done by subcontractors. The court rejected this argument and noted that the natural and ordinary consequences of improper construction techniques is eventually a breach of contract action or some sort of action against the general contractor. And again, comparing to the Carr case, which is simply a negligence action, the Carr case, in fact, went through and discussed the Hydra Corporation case, the Wilfred's case, the Viking case, and the Tillerson case, implicitly recognizing that these are the authority for courts to consider when dealing with a breach of contract or a breach of warranty. It was only able to distinguish those cases because it was a negligence action that had been brought against the general contractor in that case. The final way, according to Viking, that courts have reviewed this issue of defective construction claims regard to property damage. Numerous courts, including the Tillerson Court, have confirmed that a CGL policy is intended to protect the general contractor from liability for damages to others and is not intended for the repair and replacement of the insured's defective work, which are purely economic losses.
Is that by virtue of the policy language pertaining to property damage or the business risk exclusion or the your work exclusion?
I think both. I think that...
Well, that's kind of an analytical problem here, which is why I'm having some trouble with the Viking case.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't pick which approach is appropriate. It says under any of these approaches, no coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't give us a sort of methodology to follow. And that's why I asked about whether there was some uncertainty in Illinois about the methodology that we are to follow.
Well, I think the methodology depends on the circumstances of each individual case. And
There should be one method of construing insurance policies.
Well, no, and I think that there is. I think the Viking Court says, first you undertake to determine if there's an occurrence. If there is an occurrence, then you undertake to determine if there's property damage. And if there is, in fact, property damage, then we go and take a look at the exclusions and any exceptions thereto. However, if there is no occurrence under the policy as it's written, then we don't get to the issue of property damage. If there's no property damage, we don't get to the issue of exclusions. And so, although these are different and separate approaches, they come up as the initial question is satisfied. And as it relates to the property damage issue, if insurance companies under CGL policies are going to be held accountable for the defective work of the insurer, it transforms the insurance policy into essentially a performance bond.
What are the allegations in the underlying complaint about property damage here? I mean, do we have walls falling down or soil settlement or anything like that?
There are no allegations of anything like that. As I mentioned, it's specifically, this is what the contract required. This is how Lyola breached that contract. And I think importantly, when you evaluate that complaint, there's no reference at all to subcontractors anywhere in that complaint.
And it doesn't mention subcontractors?
No, there's the word subcontractor does not appear anywhere in the complaint or in the contract between the general contractor and subcontractor.
So the complaint just alleges faulty workmanship. It doesn't allege faulty workmanship that caused an accident.
Right. Well, and I don't know that it even necessarily alleges faulty workmanship. It alleges breach of the contractual obligation to supply the work in a workmanlike manner.
Well, that's the same thing.
Well, it certainly doesn't allege any sort of accident that occurred subsequent to that. So, and I guess the crux of the Lyola's argument is that this subcontractor exception to an exclusion somehow creates coverage in this matter. And as the Viking court outlined and as we discussed, initially there has to be an occurrence, there has to be property damage. And unless those two elements are satisfied, there's no need to look at any exclusions or any exceptions to those exclusions. Now, both Illinois and this court have held that exclusions in a policy cannot create coverage. Moreover, as I mentioned, there's no reference in the underlying complaint of any work performed by any subcontractors. Also,
we were beyond the pleading stage in this case, though. Were we at summary judgment here?
I'm sorry?
We were beyond the pleading stage in this case.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm referencing the underlying complaint again.
Okay.
And additionally, the subcontractor exception is contained within an exclusion referencing products completed operations hazard coverage. As the name suggests, it only is implicated when the work to be done has actually been completed. Now, in the underlying complaint filed against Lyola is for the failure to complete the work called for under the contract, and as such, that exclusion dealing with products completed operations hazard coverage is not implicated. And if the exclusion isn't implicated, then the exception to that exclusion has no relevance to this case. Probably the biggest example from looking at Lyola's brief that kind of ties this all together and helps to explain why this exclusion doesn't apply is by their analysis of the Tillerson decision and their attempt to distinguish that case from the case at hand. And in looking at Tillerson, there's a specific exclusion that excludes work to real property done by either the general contractor or the subcontractors. And they distinguish the Tillerson case from the case at bar because that specific exclusion was contained within the Tillerson policy. However, that exact same exclusion is found in the policy between AMCO and Lyola, and it illustrates the impossibility of trying to read an insurance policy backwards and start at the end and then work back to the beginning. You have to first establish, is there an occurrence? Is there property damage? Before you get to any of these other issues. In conclusion, there was no abuse of discretion by the district court in striking the supplemental memorandum in support of motions for summary judgment and not allowing an amended complaint when those issues were directly tied to the question of coverage and a duty to defend when those issues were already before the court in a motion for summary judgment. And clearly, both by looking at the specific language of the policy and Illinois court's interpretation of that specific language, there's no coverage under the policy, and we would ask that the court affirm the district court's decision. There's no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barson. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the third.